Good. So welcome, everyone. How many people are here for the first time? Okay. Are there some people hiding back there? Why don't you come on so I can see you? And yeah, it's nice that we can see each other. Anybody else hiding back there? You're welcome to be seen. So again, how many people are here for the first time? Number, how many people are here for maybe the second or third time? Oh, okay. So that's good. So for those who are new, usually I give who's ever up here gives a talk on a subject matter related to meditation, Buddhism, but really in terms of applying it to daily life. But what I want to do this morning is really spend most of the time answering questions. I used to do that more regularly, just every now and then, just not give a talk, but just answer people's questions. I mean, everybody here is here for some reason. Some of you are just browsing about, seeing what's going on. Others have perhaps been meditating, interested in Buddhism, for years, reading, listening to podcasts, hearing talks. So again, any questions that anybody has about anything, you know, the meditation, the mindfulness, Dharma, but also in terms of, which is really the most important thing, is how to apply it to life. You know, here we practice what we call engaged Buddhism, which means it's a spiritual practice that's deeply engaged in the reality of our life. It's meant to transform our minds and hearts in the midst of life, in the midst of relationships, in the midst of work, in the midst of all that's going on in our world, which is not easy for many of us. So questions about application, how do we engage, are also open. So please take a moment and just see. And don't be shy. I mean, there's not often that we have an opportunity to talk about these subject matters. Have real meaning to our lives. You know, what's going on in our life, how to be happy, how to stop suffering, how to help other people, you know, all these kinds of issues. You know, this is not what the world's about, is it? This is not the conversation that's going on in social media, at work. This is an opportunity that we have to really share deeply about this. So take a moment, and if you have any, if you have questions, please just raise your hand. And people online, they can raise their virtual hand, and you will call on them, and then we'll listen to their question. It's always hard to be the first one, I know that. Yes, one brave soul, good.
I'm glad to kick us off.
Good.
Hi, my name is Tammy. One of the things I've been thinking a lot about is the concept of non-attachment.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would love for you to talk a little bit about that and how to approach that in the society, in the culture that we live in. It just seems like such a black and white. Yeah.
So that, again, gets really at the heart of practice, right? Because 2,600 years ago, when the Buddha was looking at the causes of human suffering, you know, one of the big ones was that we attach, right? We attach. We attach to this life, we attach to our bodies, we attach to our image, we attach to people, we attach to, you know, things, we attach to our homes, we attach to this life, we attach to our children, we attach to our relationships, you know, we attach. An attachment means attachment, you know, it doesn't mean just touching. It means like we are attached, you know, like when you're attached to something, you know, and like wherever it goes, you go, you're attached to it. And he said this attachment, we're attached to our thoughts, we're attached to our You know, we're attached to so many things. He said, this is a cause of suffering. Like, whatever it is. Why? Because in reality, everything's impermanent. Everything is changing. Everything is just moving through process of causes and conditions. So in this world that's ever changing, right, the ordinary person's response is to what? Is to grab on and hold on, right? And when we grab on and hold on, and it's not working, then we get into all our control and manipulation strategies, right? To, like, even work it harder. And it's all because we're attached. So the Buddha said, since that's a cause of suffering, he put forward the practice, well, of non-attachment and detachment. So the Buddha founded, like a sangha of monks and nuns, right? What do they practice? Detachment, right? They don't, you know, relationships are a problem, don't have any. You know, vanity is a problem, right? Shave your head, right? Attachment to clothes is a problem. Just wear, you know, one single robe. You see what I'm saying? So the practice for non-lay people was more of detachment, renunciation. But for lay people, he gave the practice of non-attachment. Why? Because we're in the world, right? We are in the world of relationships. We are in the world of things, right? And of course, you know, when you think about the Buddha's world of 2,600 years ago and our world now, so many more things to be attached to. And in a certain way, so much more instability in all areas. Relationships, weather, climate, you know. So non-attachment, right? Easy? No. But one has to realize that because everything and everyone is impermanent and constantly changing, to grab on and try to hold and then control manipulation is only going to cause suffering for myself and often for others. So is it easy to enter into the world, to have a home, to have things, you know, to have a job, to have relationships, and to enter into them fully, at the same time not to be attached? Yeah, that's the practice. But we do it because we understand that if we attach and try to hold things to stay the way we want them to stay, it's never going to work. Has anybody noticed that? Right? I mean, this is not some kind of esoteric mystical teaching. Right? I mean, if you look at life and you realize, yeah, everything is changing, people change, my thoughts change, my feeling stage, my mind state is endlessly changing. Right? So I can either fight against that and endlessly try to manipulate even my own mind or manipulate the people around me, you know, because I'm attached to people liking me, right? That's a big one, right? I'm attached to my reputation. I'm attached to my self-image, right? So once we attach to something, we have to engage in a lot of work. Anybody notice that? We have to engage in a lot of work to maintain it and to protect ourselves. And that whole, which is so consuming in life, by non-attachment can be resolved. But so that takes understanding. So I know you're a mother, so I mean, do you love your children? Well, you always love your children. Sometimes they're a pain, right? Right. So, you know, I mean, that's a wonderful challenge because there we go, well, how can I not be attached, you see? But as they've lived with you, as they have pass through out of your body and now and take and grow, do they change? Are they constantly changing? Are you the only influence in their life? And the older they get, more and more the others are influencing. If you try to hold on to them, to be them, for them to be the way you want, right? And I'm sure as a parent you've tried that strategy. What happens? What? They change anyway. But also it creates conflict. So on the other hand, you're a parent. You want to, right? Right? You want to guide your children. You want to, right? So again, when we're not attached, it's easier. It's easier to see clearly who they are, where they are, what are their influences, and how I can help them. Right? You want to help them. But the more attached we are, that job will become more difficult. There'll be more conflict. So non-attachment is a wonderful strategy, even for the most intimate of relationships. You know, but again, how do you know, learning to enter into life fully without attachment takes time. And again, I think if we reflect, you know, I think first we need to really reflect deeply, very personally, to ask ourselves, you know, when I've been attached to things being a certain way, myself being a certain way, people being a certain way, wanting things not to change, holding on, manipulating, controlling, how does that feel? Is that conducive to a peaceful, open, loving mind? Anybody ever been there? I mean, it doesn't, right? It creates opposite mind states. As well as it, in the end, it doesn't work. As you're learning, right? I mean, they are, you know, the older they get, the more influences they are, the more they're changing. Right? You see, they're becoming who they are. And so the more you're able to kind of be with that, you see what I'm saying, in a non-attached way, the easier it will be for you to stay engaged with them, which is what we want, right? The same way comes with our possessions, our jobs, our health, our aging. You know, we're changing. And if we're attached to, you know, if I'm attached to always looking the way I did when I was 35, for those of you who are under 35, that may not make sense, but for those who are older than 35, you might, you know, if, the more I'm attached to, the, you know, looking a certain way or my body to feel a certain way, you know, I'm just going to create suffering for myself. Because what? I'm changing. The body changes. The body grows. The body gets old and it deteriorates and, right? People die, right? I mean, it's, you know, so the more we understand how things really are and we don't attach, we can be in this world of endless change and not be miserable or have lots of suffering, sadness, anger, fear. Is that helpful, Tammy? Thank you. Other questions? Yeah, online?
We have 3 questions online.
Okay.
The first is just to explain the equality complex.
People always ask questions about the equality complex. So this is in that verse which was chanted before where it says, and you know, can I be liberated from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex? And we all get those first two, right? But we've never heard about the equality complex because actually, you know, in our society, equality is very positive. So this is different. So again, you know, in Buddhist psychology, Buddhist teachings, you know, the real at the center of our suffering is our strong identification as a separate self, me, I. An I that stands apart from everyone else, a self that has all its needs and its wants, and And that identification, that strong identification as an I, me, my, as a separate self, is at the core of what kind of disconnects us from life, from people. So when they talk about those three, they're really talking about the kind of stances that self takes, right? Sometimes self thinks it's what? Better than, smarter than, brighter than, more ethical than, more, you know what I mean? We have lots of reasons many times to think we're better than, superior than others. Is that true? Right? Then some people go to the other side, right? I'm less than. Everyone's better than me, right? There's something wrong with me. I'm deficient, right? So that's the, I'm inferior. And some people actually can, you know, can do both, depending on the relationship or the time. The equality complex is very interesting. It's kind of that envy jealousy thing, like, hey, aren't we all equal? Right? Why do good things happen to them? You know, why did they get the raise, or why did they get the job, or you know, why did they get the date, or why did, you know what I mean? Like, you see, so it's that other ego state, which doesn't accept that no, we're all different. You know, some of us have certain abilities, some of us don't. Right? People have a right to make choices. So it's that kind of envy jealousy piece. So they're just, so that's what that's about. Stances of self.
Okay, Sheila is saying that she's trying to be in the here and now, mm-hmm. but wonders how to deal with an aging spouse who's obsessed with the past and what is happening, what has happened decades ago.
So, yeah, so as most of us know, we're very much in our tradition learning to live in the here and now, right? Everybody, do I have to explain that? Or are we kind of all, that's kind of like, it's not just Buddhism and Zen, it's kind of pop culture, right? So, all right, so we all want to live in the here and now. We don't want to live in the past. Past is gone. Past doesn't exist. We don't live in the future. Future is just fantasy. It doesn't really exist. All that really exists is this present moment, what's called the here and the now, right? Now, all our encounters with life occur in the here and now. They don't, you know, they don't occur in the past. They don't occur in the future. We are alive only moment to moment. This is how we're present, right? So, this woman, her husband, it sounds like he's at a place in his life where he spends a lot of time living in the past, ruminating in the past, right? If she's living in the here and now, she's present to him when he's doing that. That's what's going on. You know, it's like in the here and now, he's just talking about going on about the here and, you know, about his past. That's all you do. And then, how does she want to deal with that? In the here and now. I mean, that's, so the here and now is not a place, you see. The here and now is just where our life is actually unfolding. You know, all our lives, all that's going on from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to bed is we are alive in the present moment. So even if we're thinking about the past, we're doing that in the present moment. Even if we're fantasizing about the future, we're doing that in the present moment. Right? Like right now, all of us right here, all of us online, we're all alive in this present moment. We understand that, right? The past is just thoughts, memories. The future is just fantasies. It doesn't really exist, right? In science fiction, it exists. Fantasy novels exist, but we know those are movies and they're fiction. This is the only moment that's real. So that's why learning to show up in the present moment and learning to live our life fully in the present moment is really the key to how to live a full life, right? So if we spend all our time ruminating about the past, you know, worrying about the future, we're robbing ourselves of life, which is occurring right now. So our challenge is, how can I learn to show up in the here and now with stability and equanimity and open-heartedness, right? All those. Right? That's how we want to show up. And the present moment is wherever we are. You know, when we're home, that's our present moment. When we're with this person, that's our present moment. When we're at work, that's our present moment. Wherever we are, that's our present moment. And our challenge is, can I be totally present to my life in this moment? And that's easy compared to the way we do it, right? Because we're all over the place. And so even when we're in dealing with something in the present, we're dealing with it often in terms of the past or the future. We carry all this baggage from the past. We carry all this baggage from our worries about the future or concerns about the future. And then we contaminate this present moment and our capacity to live fully, happily, at ease within this moment. And what could be said about all these things?
And Paul wonders if Buddhism is compatible with other religions or if one has to choose.
It's interesting. You know, Buddhism is interesting because the Buddha never, you know, Buddhism is not a theology. It's not theistic, right? The Buddha taught a path of how to live an awakened life. He taught a way to live, right? Which included meditation, included ethical living, and included right livelihood. I mean, it's a path of living. He called it the Dharma, right? The Dharma is just a path of awakening, and there are lots of teachings and practices in Buddhism, psychology, that support living that way. But it's not, even though it's become a world religion, I mean, it was very interesting. I mean, when I spent a lot of time with the Tibetans, you know, they don't have a word for Buddhism. They don't call it Buddhism. You know, they call it the way or the Dharma or the path, you know. Or, if you meet people in Asia who practice, they say, oh, I practice the way of Buddha. You know, they don't have a word like Buddhism. That's kind of our Western thing. And there is going back to the Buddha, there is a ceremony for those who want to formally embrace, the path of the Buddha. We call it taking refuge. It doesn't, to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and Sangha, you don't have to give up. I mean, nobody even asks you what your religion is. So, I mean, that's not even not on the table. That's your business, right? And if you practice a religion that has meaning to you, wonderful. If you think, following aspects of the Buddhist path will be helpful for you in your life, wonderful, right? But it's not an exclusive, but it's not a theology. It's not a dogma. It's not saying, you know, you got to be, if you're this, you got to get, you can't be that. Your questions in the hall. Let's come back to the hall. Yes.
Hi, my name is Juan.
Yes, Juan.
So this is related to what you were talking about with the superiority complex. In my life right now, my grandfather, who lives in another country and I've been pretty estranged from, is dying. Mm. And I see my father in a lot of pain.
Your father's in a lot of pain.
Yes, he's in grief over it. And I... for maybe a few years now, I've taken time to create like spaces of mindfulness for myself and reading. And I've read a lot of things and I know I know it mentally, I've never felt it. And I want to find ways to...
You mentally, but you've never felt what?
Like someone dying or...
Oh, you've never experienced actually being with somebody who is dying.
Or okay. Being with someone who's in grief over someone dying.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know how to help without the superiority complex coming in or feeling like I'm preaching or anything along those lines.
Yeah, so non-attachment to views is very central to our path, especially if we want to help another human being who may have their own views. So like you're saying, if you go into a situation with your views and you're going to, you know, impose your views on them, yeah, that could be highly problematic and not very compassionate. I mean, the real practice is compassion, right? Your grandfather's dying. Your father is suffering. And your response to that is what, Juan?
I have tried to create spaces to listen, but mostly keeping to myself, just because I don't know how to approach the situation.
Yeah, I think you're looking for a strategy, aren't you? That's the problem with us these days. We're looking for strategies, right? We don't do anything without a strategy. You know, we don't trust our heart. I mean, all you do is you just have to be there for them. You have to listen to them. You have to listen to their grief, their fears, you know. You can ask questions, how they're doing, and you're just there for them. If there's some reason that they want some advice from you or some counsel for you, well, then you could share it. But, you know, my sense is, you know, I never barge in with an agenda. You know, just, you know, transition is a difficult time. Some people, death and dying, they just go with it. The other people, it's, you know, it brings up a lot, fear, anger, just, you know, or they're suffering. And people, family members, friends, your father's very attached to his father, right? And he suffers because of it. You know, death is a big one. I mean, death is probably the biggest the biggest variable in life that we never talk about. But I mean, you know, the fact that we're all going to die, and the fact that everybody in our life is going to die, and that this is normal and natural, and it's going to happen, and has happened, and will continue to happen, right, is actually normal. When you understand that, you can still grieve the loss of the relationship, but that kind of, over-the-top kind of grief that people have, like, how can this be, or it shouldn't happen, is really kind of, I don't want to use a pejorative word.
That's what I'm trying to avoid.
You see what I'm saying? You just have to help them, yeah. I mean, it's always interesting since, you know, death is so pervasive in life, and yet people seem surprised by it or shocked by it when it happens. Like, I can't believe it, right? So, yeah. You know, my sense always is ask gentle questions. You know, I mean, first just be there for your father and listen to his grief. I don't know, you might just say, Dad, did you ever think that Grandpa was going to die? It'd just be interesting what he, you know, I found early on, I mean, decades and decades ago, this is when I was getting my degree, I was doing an internship it was like a nursing home or something, I don't know, it was something that I was doing, a counseling internship. And it was very clear, because this place was also, had been like the county poorhouse, and now it was the county facility or something, but it was very clear there was only one thing going on in these people's lives, and that was waiting to die. I mean, it really was one of those kind of places. And yet it was bizarre to me. Nobody talked about death. The staff didn't talk about death. The patients never talked about death. And they had this way, somebody would die. I mean, it was just horrible. Somebody would die, and you know what they would do? These are the old days. I know we have a hospital chaplain over here. What they would do is they would immediately close all the doors on the hall so they could take the person out and nobody would see it, you know, and wheel them away. And then the next day, of course, there'd be somebody new in the bed, and I thought, so I remember once, I'd been there a couple of months, and I was running a group, and I had the audacity to say, does anybody, you know, these are a group of patients, does anybody ever think about death or dying? You know, just a little trial balloon. And it was like silence, and then people start saying, yeah, I think about it all the time. You know, so it's there, you see, but nobody talks about it. And was this helpful, Juan? Is this, yeah, trust your heart, you know, and don't go in with an agenda, don't, you know, and don't think you got to take away your father's grief, you know what I'm saying, or that's like your job, or, you know, it's so far beyond you, you know, but, you know, any way you can help, or just to be a good son, you know, let people know you love them, and even if you had issues with your grandfather, your father, you know, he's dying. You know, it's a moot point. Mm. You know, we wanna be kind to people. Okay?
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions online or in the hall? Okay. Two people here.
Hey, Fred. Wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts about, like, we live in such a world where it's so easy, as you talked about, to get stimulated into distraction or to deviate from the paths of practice. What are some really good techniques that you might have to offer for maybe newer members or people who are really trying to pick up the path on how we can be more disciplined, not just with our practice, but with our daily living? You know, what are some kind of tips or tricks, tools, quick things that can help us out?
Yeah, so we spend a lot of time, or more and more time, over the decades, talking about just this issue. And it's only speeding up, isn't it? It's only speeding up, and especially among, you know, the younger you get, the more pervasive, right? You know, omnipresent is this constant stimulation and distraction. That comes from involvement in electronic devices, right? Yeah. I mean, and right, it's endless options, right? You know, at the end of the day, the only guideline is us. You know, that's the only, because it's right there, that little thing, right? Yeah, I mean, we have to be, each of us has to reflect and go, you know, I mean, the main thing on this side is, if we don't have a purpose, if we don't have clarity about our life and what's meaningful and what's purposeful and where I want to put my energies, then there'll be nothing to counteract the seduction, the sophisticated seduction of these modern technologies. Right? I mean, these people know all the research on brain chemistry, on how the mind works, on pleasure principle. I mean, they know it. And they are creating these devices to what? What? Capture it. To just keep us, right? Deeper and deeper, more and more dependent. Yeah. So, you know, the only thing more powerful than that is a strong intention and clarity about our life, and then self-discipline. I mean, you know, we need to put parameters on ourselves, because it's so easy. You know, I don't want to sound like an old timer, but, you know, like growing up, like the phone rang, you had to walk to get to the phone. You know, now the phone is right here, right? You know what I mean? Growing up, if you wanted to go to the movies, you had to, you know, go downtown to the movie theater. You know what I mean? You know, now it's right here. You see? So, I mean, it is so accessible. It is so effortless. And the problem is change, you know, or keeping ourselves focused on what we want to be focused on takes what? It takes effort. You see? And can you see the dichotomy? This is effortless. Right? I can just turn it on and just, I don't even have to tell it. It will tell me what I'm going to watch next. I mean, can you believe the nerve of that? I mean, it's like, and now you're going to watch this, and now you're going to listen to that, and, you know. I mean, it's like, you know, if it was like a real person, you'd go, stop trying to control and manipulate me, right? If you had somebody, you know, hanging over you going, now you're going to do this. But they're so much more sophisticated. Yeah. You may, yeah, we understand you. You may be interested in this. Have you ever tried this? I mean, you know, one of the things, I had a talk with somebody this week, and this is the difficulty I think that people have with, you know, what we do here, you know, meditation, the whole process. It takes some effort, you see. It takes some training. And it takes patience. And we are also very low on patience these days. We're very high on impatience. You know, we want it now. And we can't transform our minds like overnight, because we've been structuring our minds and our reactions and our, you know, for decades, you know, so it takes time. But, so this is like an added mix into the, yeah, we have to be very disciplined. I mean, very disciplined. I mean, I'm a so-called Buddhist teacher. I've been at this 50 years. I mean, it is very sophisticated. You know, you go online to just look up something and research it. You know, before you know it, you know, they're giving you like all these other things to look at, or, you know what I mean? And, you know, it's a half an hour later, and you realize. And if you add it all up, it's like, so what? You know, all this more information, all these experiences, if you step back and go, at the end of all that, what has that all led to? And a lot of times, I don't think it leads to much of any significance. But it's taken us away from life. Yeah, so it's a real issue. We have to be very disciplined. It's funny, I was just, Angie and I had our grandchildren for 2 weeks, and you know what I did to my poor grandson? What? I put him on gaming detox. When the first day he came, because I know him. I mean, his parents are good. They sort of, you know, limit his game time. But the addiction is he's thinking about it all the time. You know, and he's talking about it all the time. And he's watching videos about gaming. You know what I mean? The people are, it's like, and so when the first day he got there, and he's very bright, he's 11. I had him look at some sites that do kind of a self-assessment on addiction. Check, check, check. So I can put you on detox while you're with us. And it was great. It was great. I mean, he was great. And all of a sudden, this space in his mind opened. I'm sure he's right back into it now. You know, now that he's home, because it's addictive, you know? The dopamine is just flowing. Yeah, I mean, Yeah, it's a challenge, right? Yeah. Good. Other questions?
Hi, my name is Morgan. Kind of goes off the first question. Is there room or such thing as existence of non-attached desire, non-attached wanting?
Yeah.
I'm thinking personally, you know, I think I take it too far sometimes, the non-attachment, and it's then, well, what do I even want?
Yeah.
What do I even, how do I make decisions about the life I want without being attached to the outcome? But is there room for pursuing of your authentic
self? Of course. Okay,
self,
so that's
and
a
life.
Good question, right? So, yeah, that's good. Okay. So, you know, lots of Buddhist teachings. There are various realms. You know what our realm is called? This human realm that we live in? It's called the realm of desire. Right? So that's the world we live in, right? You know, we wake up in the morning and the first thing we desire is what? Coffee. I mean, you know, it's like, is that mean, or tea or whatever it is. You know what I mean? You know, it's right away. It's if you think about your life, it's like a wanting, needing. You know, what do I want next? What do I want to do? So we live in the world of desire. I mean, that's not a judgment. That's just like a fact. All right? We live in the world of desire. Again, if you're a monk or a nun, your response to that is renunciation. No problem now. Right? You know, I'm going to go live away from all these people. Right, I'm just going to shave my head, and the nuns shave their heads, and I just wear robes, and, you know, very constricted life. So if that's the path you want in terms of desire, you see, that's, but as lay people, we're in the world of desire, right? As well as we know, like we're talking about media, I mean, we have an advertising industry that is fully devoted to what? Well, or just inflaming, intensifying, you know, telling us all the things we need and we want and we should have, as well as we have a society that normalizes that, right? All right. So your question is, how, if I'm going to live in the world as a layman, you know, as a householder, and have relationships and have things and want, right? You know, how do I keep it sane? How do I keep it sane?
Or how do I find it?
How do you find
it? Am I
what?
Allowed to find it?
Find what?
What I really want.
Well, of course you are. Yeah. Yeah, that's really why we're here, to find out who we really are and what's really a meaningful life. No, I think that's, you know, there's all kinds of desire. There's, you know, desire to be free, desire to be more open-hearted, desire to be less angry and more patient. Those are good desires, right? A lot of our desires, you know, are not healthy because they because they destabilize us. Like, anybody ever really wanted something really badly, you know, really like really lusted after something or really desired something, you know, like anybody ever? Is your mind at peace and calm? Yeah, so it's very disturbing. So we know that, but, you know, desiring a better life, desiring to be happy, that's not disturbing. So in the realm of desire, they're wholesome and unwholesome, healthy and not healthy. Yeah, I mean, you know, wanting a better world, wanting to be of benefit to people, wanting to help, I mean, those are good desires. So is that clear? So yeah.
Yeah.
So these are the kind. These are good questions, because people read Buddhism, and they go, you know, because you have to remember also a lot of the Buddhist teaching, the original teachings, and over the years, he was talking to his monks and nuns, remember, who were practicing the path of renunciation. So the kind of teachings he gave them were not the teachings he gave to lay people. But if you don't understand that, you kind of read these Buddhist teachings and it goes, wow, desire, bad, needing, bad, source of suffering, you know? But it's really not like that. I mean, that's on that path of renunciation, right? So our path is how do we, you know, enter the world of desire, enter the world of living and accumulation without grasping, without being attached, with accepting the unfolding of things, right? Not being attached to outcome. I mean, that's a big one, you know. It's like, you know, we're putting all this effort in. That's good. But yet, are we positive it's going to turn out the way I want? No. So, you know, not being attached to outcome is also very healthy. Okay? Is that helpful?
Thank you.
Thank you, Morgan. Other questions in the hall or online? Really, everything's been answered. Yes, wait, right there. This woman?
It's not really...
I guess I was pointing to the woman behind you, but... and then you can go. So sorry. Question, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I have so many questions. I don't know where to begin.
No, we'll just wrap them all into one or two really big ones.
What do I do about the stress of all the questions that I have? No,
all right,
I'm just
kidding. Which ones are like most important to you?
So I have I'm Kelsey, by the way. Hi.
Hi, Kelsey.
This is. I appreciate this because it's very. You know, I'm thinking a lot. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I have a particularly stressful and difficult busy season coming up at work. So when I'm sitting at my desk and I start to get anxiety and I get caught up in the, you know, I almost get so much anxiety that I freeze and I can't do anything.
Stop.
Okay.
So you're living in the future.
How?
Because you're thinking about the future and all the things that are going to come your way and it gets you, fear is always, and anxiety is always about the future.
Okay.
Right? You just said you get anxious. What do you get anxious about when you said you're overwhelmed with anxiety? What are you afraid of?
Well, I have like so many assignments that I have to do and it's all due today and right. You know.
So you're thinking about all these assignments I have to do in the future and I got to get it done by today and that's stressing you out.
Right.
That's creating anxiety. Okay. Is that helpful for you?
No.
Does it make you more productive?
No.
Does it make you enjoy your work any better? Are there any benefits to chronic anxiety? Okay, so that's, you have to be very clear, right? That response to life is not only not helpful, but it's also sabotage. Okay. So let's get rid of all the anxiety, all the worry. Now you're back at your desk. What's the problem? You have work to do? Okay. What are you going to do? I mean, you are going to do something, right? If there was no anxiety or fear, you'd still have the same work. What are you going to do? What do you want to do?
Well, if there's no anxiety and fear, I just do one task at a time and it's okay.
There it is. I mean, Kelsey, you could have written the book. I mean, that's it.
But I can't. How do you just do that?
That's you got to retrain your mind. You got to really stop living in the future and realize how defeating that is, right? You're just fantasizing, you know, that all these, I'll never get it done. You're not just only thinking about it. It's like you're thinking about it in a negative way. I'll never get it done. That's too much. I can't do all this, right? I mean, that's what's defeating you. So changing the way our mind thinks is very much part of this practice. You know, we want to have a healthy mind, don't we? Right. Yeah. So you come to work, you see the pile, and you just prioritize, right? Which is what you're going to end up doing anyhow. And you do what you can. And at the end of the day, hopefully you put it down and don't let it disturb your evening. So you can enjoy life. You think that's possible, Kelsey? You're not sure, are you? Yeah, so it's sort of what I was saying a few minutes ago. This is the problem, you see. This gentleman next to you, I can see you're strong. You work out? You work out. Yeah. Were you ever a 90-pound weakling?
Yeah.
Okay. How did you get from being a 90-pound weakling to a man who's strong, and right? How'd you do it? Just
consistent work.
Okay. Did you hear that? Do you want to? Can you give him the microphone? Just say it aloud.
Consistent work.
All right. I mean, you know, it's funny. We understand that, right? So if somebody's here and they're kind of their body's weak and they don't have a lot of energy and they want to develop, you know, more of a healthy body, right? They'll either start on their own or go to the gym or something, start training, and they'll learn, no, you're not going to have a body you want tomorrow, right? It's going to take you what? Time. And you're going to have to, you know, be disciplined, right? But would you agree, what's your name?
Nick.
Nick, would you agree that anybody who undertakes the discipline and is consistent and is patient will, you know, yeah, I mean, this is not some mystical thing, is it, Nick?
No.
No, it's all right. But when it comes to our mind, we don't understand. It's the same thing. We have to develop strength of mind. Right? So in meditation, mindfulness, concentration, this is how we develop mental muscles, which then we can apply in life. Okay? But just, Kelsey, by beginning to really accept that anxiety is defeating you and it's produced in your own mind, because the way you're thinking about and responding to what you're doing at work, and that's got to change, right?
So in that moment, I guess I can think of tools to practice, like, I'm sitting at my desk and I see, you know, the things piling up and the emails coming in, and I can think, okay.
Stop.
Now this
Stop.
Is
what... Take a breath. Uh-huh. Just relax. You know, as soon as you begin to see her ramping up, help her. Don't desert her. That's what the problem is. We desert ourselves, right? I mean, you know, she's starting to freak out and you just kind of pile it on her, right? Maybe she forgot about all this other work. So stop. Relax. Come back to your body. Come back to your breath. Talk yourself off the cliff. You've got to learn to talk to yourself, right? As if you're a person who needs your help. Talk her off the cliff. Talk her down. Talk to her just this way I'm talking to you. You know, you calm her. Okay. What are we going to do first? That's all. Let's just stay focused. Do you talk to yourself that way? Historically?
No. I mean, sometimes I'll become aware and then I try to just slow down and like calm myself down, like, okay, this, you know.
But you see, if she's already agitated, it's very hard, have you noticed that? Yeah, I mean, once the horse is out of the barn and running, you know, you're just kind of holding on, right? So you got to get it early. You know, my sense is, you get it before you go to work. You know, is this a common problem? There's always too much to do and too little time. Yeah. So I mean, and how long has this been going on?
2 years.
2 years. All right. So you're. All right, so you're a pro at this. You know the way it's going to be, right? Yeah, so you got to, you know, go to work with, you know, you got to prep your morning meditation, you stabilize yourself, you calm yourself, you have a conversation with yourself about work, you imagine, you know, just going to work and showing up the way you want, and okay? You know? Don't just walk in blind like expecting there's going to be nothing on your desk and no emails are going to come in. Right? I mean, you gotta be wise. right? And have your strategy and do your best to stick to it. And the important thing is if you see her begin to rev up, stop, which is very hard for us. Stop. You know, just stop. Put it down. Come back to yourself. Come back to your breath. Come back to your body. And then when you're in a good place and you've talked to yourself, then begin again. But people just they do a quick pause. But that quick pause is not going to do it because the energy is already moving in that direction. You know what I mean? It'll be worth it because you'll be more. But you might say, "Oh, I can't do that." You know, I got so much to do, right? Oh, I can't stop. But that anxiety will stop you. You know, I'd rather stop for something that's helpful. Okay, so learning, you know, to have a relationship with your body, breath, to be able to come back to it, that takes time. Calming, stabilizing, talking to yourself, everything's okay. Yeah.
Thanks.
All right. Yeah. Anybody else in the hall have a question? Oh, you okay.
My question.
Okay. Anybody online? So everybody's good? What? Somebody has a question? You have a question.
Thank you. So I'm Kim. I've asked you before and I didn't quite understand it.
Okay.
Could you speak about Buddha nature and is it permanent?
So this is the deep end of the pool.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is it? Well,
Buddhism.
Buddha nature is kind of a good little teaching.
No, Buddha. No. So. Oh.
What is Buddha nature?
Yeah. So what is Buddha nature? Well, the truth is there's no such thing as Buddha nature. It's just a word. Okay. And actually, the Buddha never talked about Buddha nature. It's after. And it's a little controversial in the realm of Buddhism because the basic teachings of Buddha is there's no solid thing. So to say there's something. But we can talk about characteristics. Right, and so, you know, if there's anything called Buddhism, it's all because of this man, the Buddha, and it all came from his great enlightenment. Right, he didn't read it in a book. He didn't, you know, he went his own way, and he looked deeply into his own mind, and his great discovery was that this constructed self and all the thoughts and concepts around who I am and who everything is was just the superstructure of the mind. And then actually when he looked more deeply into the mind, he saw actually the mind itself is just this completely undefiled, pure awareness, empty of all characteristics. Right? So when we talk about Buddha nature, we're really talking about that nature of the true nature of our mind, right? So in other words, it's raining here, goes online, it's raining here. That's water. What is the nature of water? It's fluid. It just flows. Now, if you saw an ice sculpture, right, you would say, oh, solid, and it has a shape. Let's say it's a nice sculpture of a horse. You'd say, oh yeah, that's a horse, it's solid, right? It's a thing, it's a horse, right? The world of characteristics, that's the world we live in, the way things appear. But the Buddha discovered just that we can discover, if you've ever, anybody ever, you know, been to these parties or something where they have, you know, or fairs where they have ice sculptures? Right. If you hung around there for a number of hours, what would you begin to notice? What? What? It would reveal its true nature. You see? It appeared to be a solid thing called a horse. But when we look more deeply, we realize it's just water, and it can flow into anything, right? That ice sculptor can take that water and, by freezing it, create anything. The same way a sculptor can take clay and create anything with that clay. But the fundamental nature, even though there may be 1,000 different forms that clay has taken, it's all clay. And what is the nature of clay? It's pliable. Right? It's pliable. Right? So from that point of view, we, each of us, are kind of have frozen our nature into a construct of self. Me, you, him, her, and all these ideas and all these stories, and we maintain them by memory. You know, we just keep endlessly reifying our belief like the ice horse. See, the ice horse, right, thinks, wow, look at me. You know, I'm the center of this beautiful buffet, and everybody's coming around me and saying, wow, what a beautiful, right? He doesn't know that what? It's not going to last. What? Yeah, that his nature is going to reveal itself. Right? And all of a sudden he starts to melt and he begins to panic. Because he doesn't identify with his water self, the true self of who he is. And that's what our problem is. We do manifest as, like you manifest as Kim, and you've had your life, and you have your stories, and you have your, you know what I mean? And you've constructed this whole thing, but it's all constructed out of this much vaster, purer mind awareness. And when we know that, that's a very different experience than the self-identification. Because then we get into all these things like anxiety, right? See, I mean, you tell me about what goes on at work, right? And all that work, and I'm very calm. I can listen to it, right? Because I don't identify with it. Because I'm not you. You see what I'm saying? But you really identify with Kelsey, don't you? And her work, and she's got to get it done. And that constricts her. So kind of knowing that we're also water, you know, and our mind is very open and pliable and aware, you know, gives you space. And it's an easier way to live life, to have some space in our mind than have it always constricted. And we constrict around our stories of who we are and what's going on and what's going to happen and what did happen. You know, we've constructed a story from our past. I'm a this and I'm a that. It's all just constructed. Right? Anyhow, that's the deep end of the pool in Buddhism. Any other questions online or here in the hall? Here's your chance. Everybody's clear? Understand the teachings, know how to apply it?
Hi, my name is Willow. And my question is about the delusion that I have that I can change someone else, or that I'm important enough to be able to help them or save them from their folly.
Yeah, so...
Stop doing that.
Well, I mean, but that's interesting. Look the way you said it. I mean, that's how crazy we are. You introduced that saying, I have this delusion that I can change other people. How can I stop this? you know it's a delusion because you've spent how much of your life trying to change people?
Mucho time.
And just unremitting success?
Fruitless endeavor.
Fruitless endeavor. And yet, you're asking me...
My insanity is that I keep trying again and again in one particular area of my life. I've managed to really improve.
Well, we could talk a lot about that. But I think one way is to really go in and go, what's underneath this? So you're... And I think this is often where we need to look when you're saying, I know this is counterproductive. I know this is not going to work. I know this is causing me suffering. And you probably have noticed that people don't like to be controlled either.
Right.
I mean, does anybody, if you don't think you need to be fixed, do you like anybody else telling you you need to be fixed? Does that kind of bring you closer to them? No, I mean, nobody likes it anyhow, and they're not going to listen to you, right? So when you see yourself acting in this kind of irrational, counterproductive way, over and over, and when intellectually you know better, right? That's what you're saying. You know better. You know there's something else down here, right? And that's where we need to look. There's another part of me that will not let this go. And that's, I think, a very important for us psychologically to understand that we are conditioned, you know, by our past. And especially when we have these kinds of struggles between our head and kind of our, I don't know, not heart. But you know what I'm saying? That you really go, yeah, there's something else going on here. You know, because rationally, I get it. And yet there's another part of me that's obviously wanting or needing something. Or just doesn't get it. You know, I often say to people, we show up in like what we're doing today. We show up with our intellectual cognitive mind. You know, it's curious, it wants to learn. You see. But the problem is, the bigger part of our mind is our conditioned mind. Right? And we think because we get it up here, we're actually going to be able to live it. You know, so what I often say to people is, you know, like, you're learning the Dharma, right? Now you need to teach the Dharma to your deeper self, because he or she is not going along with the program. Has anybody noticed that? I mean, has anybody noticed, like, you've read the books, you've thought about it, you've been on the retreats, it's like all makes perfect sense. And somehow in the reality of your day-to-day life and relationships, you still kind of continue to do it the old way. Has anybody noticed that? Yeah. Well, why is that? It's because, you know, we have a conditioned mind. And many of it's been conditioned for decades and decades and decades. And that, we need to engage with that part of our mind. Right. Because, you know, intellectual understanding will not really move us forward. So that's what practice is. You know, when we meditate, we learn to look deeply into our mind, we see deeper things about ourselves, things that need to be healed, things that need to be changed, right? Yeah, so that's good, you know, but, yeah. Thank you. All right, so thank you, everyone. Oh, let me just give you a little quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. This is a very important practice. Live your daily life in a way that you never lose yourself. When you are carried away with your worries, fears, cravings, anger, desires, you are running away from yourself and you will lose yourself. The practice is always to go or to come back to oneself. So it's a practice, right? And sort of we come back to where we started this morning with our meditation, what are we doing? Learning to establish a relationship with our body, our breath, a place that we can come back to, a place that we can take refuge in, right? That's more stable and more permanent and consistent than these, you know, endless arisings of thoughts and feelings and responses, situations, right? So, you know, like Kelsey was saying, or you were saying, you know, it takes practice. You know, we it's not just going to happen. We have to kind of develop a ground and a relationship with ourselves so we don't just get swept away by this, you know, this reactivity and emotionality. But it will happen. Right, Nick? Right, just stay with it, right? Be disciplined, right? And our mind will grow strong too. Thank you, everyone.